This is an interview with Governor Vicatia at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is May 20th, 1993, and this is tape 27, side one.
As long as it was all generic, let's use tide, let's use wind, mm-hmm. and then everybody could kind of impede whatever we wanted to do. Once you get a determination, this could be done, this is how much you could generate, this is how much it's going to cost, this is how long it'll take to get there. At least now you've got some plan of action. You've got something to look at, something to determine what needs to be done and how to go about doing it. Again, this is a matter to assure ourselves of energy. Mm-hmm. And so these are all behind my whole thoughts in terms of a Department of Energy, what we're supposed to be doing, how we're going to go about doing it. And incidentally, conservation was one of them, and it's probably the cheapest mm-hmm. source of energy we can get. Mm-hmm. But those are the reasons that we began to delve into this whole matter of energy, because I was concerned about our future needs for energy, whether or not the state was going to develop in the way it should.
What was your feeling about a state-run utility?
I always opposed that. That was Bob Straub's idea. Mm-hmm. I don't think the state can do things better than private enterprise can. Mm-hmm. Don't believe that.
How about the whole issue about getting our fair share of low-cost energy from the federal government? And
that was a hard nut to crack. Mm-hmm. Oregon has remained pretty much in the realm of the investor owns, and Washington has been pretty much the realm of public utilities. And that's just not a nut that's hard and easy to crack. And there's the advocates for PUDs, public mm-hmm. people utility districts or whatever, and they're advocates for investor-owned. I don't know if you can say one is really better than the other, and yet, at the other hand, if there's competition, I always believe competition is good, and it's good for a consumer. So that's where the investor owns come in.
How was your feeling, and what involvement did you have with the Northwest Power Bill that was before Congress at the time?
I really would take credit for it.
Really?
I don't do that very often. But I thought it was very important that we deal with energy as a large lake, meaning the lake would be Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Western Montana, mm-hmm. and that you can't lower one part of a lake, and you can't, it's just got to be, one lake. So I sent Lee Johnson to do my Kissinger thing. Let's go out and talk to the governors, which he did, the shuttle thing. I said, don't back them into any corner at all. Just go back and talk to them and tell them what we're after and what we're trying to do and how we want to achieve it. And so he talked to Schwinden, he talked to Evans, he talked to then Dixie, Lee Ray, and it kept moving around, and we finally evolved what we thought would be the right plan. Once the governors agreed, then the bill began to move. It wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't going to go anywhere. It was just there. Just sitting there. And one of the keys was who's on the Power Planning Council. Well, first of all, that there would be a Power Planning Council, that it wouldn't be just the federal government running this whole thing, and that there would be a Planning Council, and it would, the key was that there would be two members from each state. That was a little tough to push down Washington's throat, because Washington had the largest population, mm-hmm. and one man, one vote kind of thing. But we finally got that part of it done. I think by and large that's worked to our benefit, although there's been some arguments about it. But once we achieved that, then it was just a matter of going and getting the job done. Mm-hmm. And if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have a Northwest Power Plant.
So did the Northwest Power Bill go through Congress pretty much intact then?
Pretty much. Uh-huh. Pretty much, yeah.
And it's still the basis of which the Northwest is operating on?
Today, yeah. Uh-huh.
Did you actually go back to Washington at any point, or did any of your Did you have any representatives?
No, we had some pretty good communication. And in Congress, once the affected parties agree, mm-hmm. makes it a lot easier. And each governor can talk to his own senators and representatives, and which we did, and they did.
Was one of our senators carrying the bill? Hatfield or Packwood?
I think Hatfield was the lead senator from Oregon, that mm-hmm. is. I don't recall if they got together and figured out who was going to mm-hmm. lead that fight. The introduction, incidentally, of Fish was our proposal out of my office, mm-hmm. which is the one that's creating a problem right now. And that really was part of it. So I would say that my administration had a major part to play in the fact that there was a Northwest Power Planning Council.
What about the Pebble Springs nuclear project?
Pebble Springs is, isn't that the coal fire plant?
No, that's Boardman.
No, that's Boardman. That's right. You're right. My own personal view was there's no sense fighting that fight. You're not going to get it done. There's too much political pressure against a nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a matter of moratorium and anything else. It's just a pragmatic recognition that it just wasn't going to happen. Just mm-hmm. isn't going to take place.
Did you want it to take place?
I didn't think it was essential. I wasn't fighting it. I wasn't for or against it. I just said, this isn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. There's times in which you use your energy where you think you've got a chance, and there's times when you say, there's no sense fooling around with this sort of thing. It isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. there was a Senate bill, 644, that had awards for alternative energy designs. Was that something that your task force took a look into or had a part in?
I can't recall that specifically.
Energy?
There was a lot of people jumped on board and in the legislature, and that was okay. Some good ideas.
Was the Senate bill, this other bill, Senate Bill 927, it was concerning an alternate energy development plan and a comprehensive presentation. Was that part of the task force? I mean, was there much interaction between the task force and what was going on in the legislature regarding it?
Not during this 79th session. They were at work. Well, they actually went to work after the session.
I see.
And they made their report to the 81 legislature.
I see. You ordered Public Utility Commissioner John Loebdel to take the first step to obtain low-cost federal power for Oregon homes and farms through the Domestic and Rural Power Authority. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that was again Bob Straub's DERPA.
His what?
DERPA. Domestic and Rural Power
Authority. Oh. What happened to that?
I can't remember.
I guess that announcement startled critics who had been predicting that the free enterprise Republican governor would never activate the state power authority to put forward by his predecessor, Bob Straub.
Wasn't a bad idea. You know, you think of things in the political sense, and you know, it might work. I didn't hold out much hopes for it, but it might. Mm-hmm. Give it a try.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction from the power companies?
Oh, I'm sure they were particularly happy with that. I don't remember.
The paper also said that Atiyah indicated he is ready to call for a state takeover of public utility districts or private power companies or both if necessary to win Oregon's fair share of cheap federal electricity. Only 20%.
This is
right
all
now.
Saber rattling. That's all that is.
Did you really mean this? No,
I had no idea. Attention to do anything like
so
that.
So why were you doing it then?
You were saber rattling. You get things.
Why were you trying to stir things up?
Oh, just to get people's attention in terms of energy, the need for energy, and the mm-hmm. fact that we have to cooperate to get the job done. Mm-hmm. And if we try to do it all by ourselves, one at a time, PP&L, PGE, you know, they're going to do their thing, PP&L do their thing, and we've got PUDs, they're going to do their thing. You know, you don't have a comprehensive policy. So let's get together and work together.
Uh-huh. So you're basically stirring up the mud at the bottom of the glass.
Yeah, let's get together. Uh-huh. I mean, if we're going to serve Oregon, you can't serve it in pockets with ignorance and totally ignore anybody else that's providing power.
The papers also said that you preferred congressional passage of a proposal to reallocate the federal dam-generated electricity. The plan at that point had been approved by the U.S. Senate, but was stifled in the House.
Yes. When the Bonneville Power thing came along, there was the PUDs had first crack at the power, and that what was left was to be sold to the private utilities at a higher rate. But the PUDs always had preference. They had preference of any shortage. First one's cut off would be the investor owns. It's always put Oregon at a disadvantage because of our major utility companies.
Mm-hmm.
We're always a threat that we will get cut off. And so that's why we wanted more assurance for the Oregon. We have PUDs, but our large ones are PP&L.
Right.
And we had to assure ourselves, but it was always an uncertain thing. Because whenever it became, we had a low year water or something, the preference always went to the PUDs, which is mostly Washington.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That left Oregon consumers kind of in a bad position.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything else on your energy policies at this point, or proposals?
There really wasn't, in the terms of the theory. What I'm trying to do is to get a comprehensive, well-thought-out plan for power for Oregon, and to remove some of the doubts and questions that existed. So all these other things came into play.
Would this be an appropriate time to talk about your ideas concerning the econometric system for Oregon, for the state?
Yeah, because this is when it started.
Uh-huh.
It was activated in 81, but it began in 1979. It actually came out of my executive department and Bob Smith. And of course, I was fully aware that all these years prior, we had, I think it was Paul Eggers, as a matter of fact, that comes to my mind now. But he was a single state economist.
Hmm.
And he was the one that would tell us what was expected in terms of income for a two-year period. And we could never really ask a question. You know, did you take into account congressional action? Did you take into account a wet season or dry season? Because that's what he was selling. See, the formula, whatever formula he ever had, was in his head. If he gave it to us, we didn't need him anymore.
But isn't that a rational thing to ask for what factors?
Very rational.
Uh-huh.
So we embarked on the econometric model. And basically that software is what it is. And we also instituted an economic advisory committee, which is still in existence today. People take it for granted, but it's there. Took a while to shake it down because there were some mistakes in it. We ran it, still using Paul Eggers. We ran it.
Oh.
So you see how it was coming out. You know, you have to run these computer things. And even when we finally converted, in other words, Paul Eggers was no longer there, we were on the econometric model, there were some mistakes and things that were kind of left out, mm-hmm. or weren't plugged in. Because you get the model, but then you had to adapt it to Oregon and our tax laws and our industries and those kinds of things. So it took us a while, but it was a very fortuitous thing. I thought it was good for government. Fortuitous in the sense that when we started to hit our downturn, we had to be up to snuff. We had to do it on a quarterly basis. We couldn't do it on an annual or a biannual basis because it's too late to do anything about it. And it was particularly valuable in 82 because we could keep pretty up to snuff. And When our economist came to see governor, we're going to be $200 million short. You know, you're able to deal with it right away, because if you each day you wait, you're spending money each day, and you have a shorter period to save money. So it worked out very well. Today it's been very useful to legislature and the governors, but now it's just assumed it's always been there. It's not always been there. It began in our administration.
Looking back on it, it had a very rocky road ahead of it. And judging by the number of special sessions that followed, do you feel that it still would have been better than the previous method at that point in getting it?
There's no question. If we had not done that, we would have been in real trouble. Real trouble. First of all, a single economist cannot predict nearly as well as this econometric model can. And then you pit that, you put that alongside an economic advisory council, which are real people that are economists themselves, for the banks and down the University of Oregon and those kinds of, you know, those kinds of folks. And, and they can analyze what the machine is telling them. It's about as good a way as you can to really get a pretty good handle on what the future of the state's going to be.
Is that used across the country pretty much?
Pardon?
Is it used across the country pretty much by other states?
I don't know how many states do use that. I have no idea. The complexity of this problem is immense. The legislature is now working on the budget today. And the budget that they're working on today is the budget that will commence July 1, 1993. The governors have been working on this budget. They were working on this budget in beginning about the middle of 1992. And so they're working on building the budgets to present to the legislature this session for the next 2 years, starting July 1. And we have to begin to plan, start thinking back there in 92, what's going to be the condition of the state of Oregon in January 1995. So you see, what we're trying to deal with is a pretty complex matter. And for someone to sit there and figure out in their own head all of the complexities of what might happen, Congress, legislature, economy, wet weather, dry weather, they're in the woods, they're out of the woods, spotted owl, who knows what, and on it goes, to sit down and figure out what the income is going to be is not an easy task. So you begin to see why this econometric model with an economic advisory council is a really good idea. You get some pretty good handle on what needs to be done. That's why in 82, when I called the three special sessions, you know, we were able to jump right in. Governor, we're going to be short. We'll jump in right away. And then we jumped in June. We jumped into September. Because that was September of 82, and the biennium would have ended in June of the next year. So we had 15 months. No, not that long. 9 months to save money. We had to jump right in and get the job done. So it helped. Another fortuitous thing happened. And what that really amounted to was in welfare. Now, you're on the econometric model. I think we pretty well covered that one. And I said to myself, we've really got to reform welfare. We've got to do something about this. And it was not on the theory that there's a bunch of lazy people out there that are just want to hang on and take tax dollars. It's the fact that there's a lot of people there that didn't want to be there, and that we had to help through the process as much as we can. So we began reforming welfare, and in a variety of ways, we pared down the size of the welfare load. That was fortuitous, because when the time came and we had to make all these cuts, we didn't have that overburden, which we would have had if we'd left welfare alone. And one of those things you didn't know was going to happen. You just knew that was good government. But it worked in our favor when the recession really hit us.
You had a number of other bills that you sponsored as governor. one, which was Senate Bill 2, was on criminal records access and authorization and criminal justice agency designation. Do you recall what you were trying to accomplish in that?
I don't. I think if you get another chance, if there's summaries on bills. Was that the only summary you had?
This is the only summary I had from the journal. But
I don't recall that.
Being early on in the, and being Senate Bill number 2, I thought that was probably something you must have introduced as the session had opened.
Well, those things are all you plan early.
Yeah.
And get into the process early.
You had another Senate bill on Indian matters, of course, that was always a concern of yours.
Yes.
And you carried that on in through your governorship. What were you trying to accomplish then as governor in the realm of Indian affairs?
I had a great respect for the Indians in Oregon. Actually, what I was going through and during my period of term as a governor was the return to tribal status of many tribes. Mm-hmm. I attended the ceremony. The first of those was Siletz. They were the first one to have their tribal status restored. Now that's a little bit different because we have the Umatillas and we have the Warm Springs and we have the Paiutes. These are all reservations in Oregon. Mm-hmm. But there was a period of time during Eisenhower's administration. So we shouldn't have these things anymore. These people should integrate into the United States, mm-hmm. Become American, totally forget the Indian stuff. So a lot of the tribal statuses were just dropped. They just no longer had a tribal status. Tribal status had some meaning in terms of their being able to deal with the federal government. And mostly social programs, but the fact is they could deal with the government. So during my period of time, a lot of that happened. It always took the acquiescence of a governor. Mm-hmm. For a return of tribal status. I think the Grand Ron were the next ones. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember in order how that came. And I was supportive of it.
Mm-hmm. You also had a bill on interstate cooperation, interstate cooperation committee, and also a proclamation on the International Year of the Child.
Oh, that was, yeah, I laughed because there was a Year of the Woman and Year of the Child, and it got a lot of static. All of those got static from the conservative side of the conservative philosophy, right wing kind of folks. They thought everyone was meddling in things. Yeah, those are all good things.
There was also a House joint resolution on the succession line. Was there a change in the order of succession of the governor?
There was, but it had nothing to do with the legislature. It was a referendum. Not sure when it took effect, to be honest with you. I do know that all during my term as governor, I was governor. Whether I was out of the state, out of the country, it didn't make any difference. I was still governor. In prior times, and I don't remember when that took place, it went to the vote of the people to change succession. I don't remember what year that was. Prior to that, if the governor went to Vancouver, Washington, the Senate president became governor.
Right.
And it just didn't make any sense under today's communication and transportation. It just didn't make any sense. So the League of Women Voters actually made the change.
Huh.
Prior to that, it was governor, Senate president, speaker, secretary of state, state treasurer. After that, it was governor, secretary of state, state treasurer, Senate president, speaker of the House.
Uh-huh.
But also after that, the governor remained governor. There was nobody stepped in.
Only if his
death
occurred.
Or illness of some kind or something like that. That's correct. But it was great. It was very comforting to know mm-hmm. that there wasn't anybody else there in charge. And there was no need for it.
Yeah.
There's really no need to have that kind of thing take place, except for these emergency situations. So, I don't know what maybe the legislature wanted to change it. They didn't like it, but I don't know what that bill was. Mm-hmm. But it was the League of Women Voters that actually made the referral to the people, and the people passed it.
In your first major address, it was at a luncheon of the Northwest Agricultural Show. You, according to the newspaper, scorched the U.S. Department of Labor for a shortage of field help.
Of what?
Field help. You said, we know that it is simplistic and ineffective to look toward the ranks of the unemployed for labor. And you call for the implementation of the program allowing U.S. products to contract for foreign labor.
Yeah, well, it's again one of these theories. They say, well, you know, why use migrant labor? There's a lot of people unemployed. Go use them that are citizens. But that's not the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean either in the lives of the migrant worker or the farmer. The migrant worker actually looks forward to these opportunities to make some money. And but there's always that illegal alien and all that sort of thing going on. So they come up with this theory that, you know, don't use migrant labor, use the unemployed. And these things don't work. They don't work that way. And I keep coming back to the real world rather than this is the way it, well, why don't you do it this way? Well, this way isn't going to work, meaning their way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why.
You also had an Oregon wilderness bill that maybe that's a oxymoron, but it would reduce the U.S. Forest Service's recommended wilderness by acreage by 83.3%. And it was presented to the Oregon delegation in Washington, D.C. Of course, Oregon environmental groups lambasted the plan.
I was going through, again, this wilderness thing. Oregon already had 1.2 million acres of wilderness. But the Forest Service was having their wilderness study. How much more wilderness to add? I don't remember that particularly, but I was recounting even this morning for another reason. We made our own study in my office. It's my recommendation for how much more wilderness should be added in the state of Oregon. I recommended 25,000 acres. Jimmy Carter recommended 400,000 acres. The industry was just went bonkers about that. Hatfield finally came up with his proposal at 600,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't like that either. When it finally passed, they added 1.2 million acres. They should have taken Jimmy Carter's offer.
Another 1.2 million?
Another 1.2 million acres. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, when you start talking about spotted owl and things like that, I say, fine, okay, let's give the spotted owl 2,000 acres. But give us back 2,000 acres out of wilderness. No, 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 no. We want the wilderness and we want the spotted owl. So I also proposed at one time that the state take over all of the duties of the U.S. Forest Service. That didn't fly very far. Well, that was a good idea.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that because later on then you revisited that issue when a possible addition to the hidden wilderness system and some land that your family had been connected with up near Detroit Lake.
Opal Creek, yeah,
right,
yeah,
right, and
okay.
Your nephew.
We'll get to that.
Okay. You also recommended that the state's three boundary commissions be abolished because, according to Lee Johnson, to the extent that they are political decisions, the responsibility should be vested in the locally elected officials rather than appointed state commissions, and the LCDC already makes land use decisions. But many felt that the boundary commissions were making other than land use decisions, for example, service and tax base issues.
I didn't see any need for it. And it, again, it gets back to my theory of government. And although it does happen an awful lot, meaning non-elected people effectively passing laws.
Were they, in fact, abolished, the boundary commissions?
I don't know.